exploiting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we look at a thought-provoking memoir. We'll talk with author Rosa Del Duca about her book, Breaking Cadence, One Woman's War Against the War. Later in the program, we're rejoined by Nolan Higdon. We'll talk about the Bernie blackout, media framing, and propaganda in the 2020 election. Stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are featuring an author who has written somewhat of a memoir. It's a story of her journey as a young recruit before the events of September the 11th, who ended up in the National Guard. It traces her journey all the way to Conscientious Objector. We are joined today by Rosa Del Duca. Rosa is a writer, journalist, and musician. She grew up as a tomboy in rural Montana, as she describes, where she joined the Army National Guard at 17 years old. And during her long contract, Rosa became not only a conscientious objector, but a feminist and unlikely rebel. That tumultuous time is the focus of her memoir, Breaking Cadence, One Woman's War Against the War. That's out from Ooligan Press, two O's, O-O-L-I-G-A-N, Ooligan Press. And her companion podcast, Breaking Cadence, Insights from a Modern Day Conscientious Objector. Rosa Del Duca, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So this is a memoir. Starting back at 17 in 2000, that means you're still a young woman here. You're under 40, and you have chronicled, you know, a pretty significant story and series of events. So why don't you just share with our listeners your story and what pushed you into cataloging all this in such a significant memoir?
The book actually starts when I'm about 15, because it sets up some of the circumstances and reasons why I leapt at the National Guard contract when the recruiter came through school. We grew up on and off welfare. My dad wasn't in the picture. My mom was raising three girls on her own, had a bad back, and trying to go back to school to earn her education degree. So the book sets up some circumstances of, you know, like me wanting to get out of small town Montana. I really, really, really wanted to go to school and study journalism and be a writer. So when all the recruiters started going through my little high school, and I lived in this town so tiny, it didn't even have a gas station. It's called Fromberg, and it's in eastern Montana. If you blink on the highway, you miss it kind of situation. The one store in town is, no joke, called The Store. So, you know, I tuned out the other recruiters when they came through, because they billed it as a full-time thing. Like, you do your 2 years or 4 years of the Marines or Army, and then you might go to college. But when the National Guard guy came in, you know, this suave, good-looking guy, and he billed it as, this is just 2 weeks in the summer and 1 weekend out of the month. 1 weekend a month, you do your soldier thing, drill, and the rest of the time, you're a college student, you're doing whatever job. At that point, they were offering 75% of your college tuition paid for. And so, you know, I was doing the math. I was like, that's 90% civilian, 10% soldier. I can definitely do that. And if you do get called up, you might get called up to help fight a forest fire, which as a tomboy, like, I was really into sports and liked measuring myself against guys and doing kind of crazy thing like climbing rocks and jumping off stuff. It just sounded exciting and cool. So my mom made me think about it for 2 whole weeks, because at 17, you do have to have someone co-sign for you. And yeah, I joined. And then about 9 months later, 9/11 happened. And by this time, I was going to college at the University of Montana. And I was so young still and so naive that I honestly thought that the New York National Guard would get called up to clean up the mess in New York City, and that would probably be it. Clearly, that's not what happened.
You and many, many others. I was teaching college in 2000. I had just started teaching college in California. And a lot of the folks that I had around 9/11 into 2001 and 2, they had really similar stories about signing up during so-called peacetime and the way that it was framed and sold to them by recruiters with the college education and the people that they tended to target. So your story really fits into that narrative.
I now work with this truth and recruitment group, and one of the members is a GI Rights Hotline counselor. She's been doing it for forever. And she said when 9/11 happened, yeah, there were a ton of calls from all these people. This stuff doesn't make the news. All these people who had major qualms and were kind of freaking out about the idea of going to war when that's really not what they were expecting. But when you're in it, you look around and everyone's just doing their job. You are in boot camp and AIT. It's such a strict atmosphere and culture that any dissent of any kind is just so taboo. So as I started to have doubts, you know, I understood Afghanistan, you know, go after the terrorists responsible for 9/11, you know, and at that point there were no Afghanistan papers to tell us what was really going on. But the way the war in Iraq unfolded, that's what really started to get under my skin. And I started to have those doubts, but I really just shoved them down because I thought I had no choice about anything and no one else looked like they felt at all like I did. And I started feeling like, oh, am I a wuss? Am I a coward? Am I the spoiled girl who wants to take some money for college and run? I have a lot of self-doubt about it until a certain point when I was just like, I can't do this. I can't be complicit.
What you're seeing in your own experiences didn't seem to add up or didn't seem to line up with the media propaganda blitz that so many people were subjected to here in the U.S.
Yeah, media propaganda blitz. I love that how you put that. It just felt like the Bush administration was lying on a daily basis to everybody, and people just seemed so checked out and removed from it. I were walking around campus, people were talking about, oh, how tough this professor is and how stressed they are about this and blah, 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 blah. We were at war in two countries. And you would walk around campus, walk around town, and nobody seemed to, it wasn't making people's radar. And to me, it just seemed like everything was being taken at face value, like, you know, voting to go to war because of this, this, and this, unproven theories. But I was lucky in that when I moved to California, I really got into radio. I loved my campus radio station, and I became the news director, and I hunkered down in there a lot.
What campus was that again?
This is Cal Poly San Luis Obispo.
Okay.
We were playing Democracy Now! And contrasted with the papers that I was reading, and I had gotten an internship at News Talk 920 KVEC, and in between their local newscasts, they were playing Rush Limbaugh back-to-back with Sean Hannity. These very stark differences in how people were covering the war and expressing opinions about the war. Like, Amy Goodman was the only person I was exposed to who was describing our presence there as an occupation.
Very few journalists, actually, right? Mm-hmm. Amy Goodman, one of them. Certainly on the run-up to that invasion in March of 2003, Phil Donahue, with his producer Jeff Cohen, who founded Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and the people at MSNBC at the time told Jeff and Phil that if they didn't have two or three pro-war people on, that it wouldn't be considered, quote, balanced, because Phil Donahue was asking questions, doing something that journalists are technically supposed to do. But I remember that time. It definitely was filled with spin and propaganda. So you joined the Guard in 2000. Tell the people this timeline here of you're still in the Guard when you're in California.
Yeah, the shortest contract in the National Guard, the standard contract, is 6 years. And really, it's 8 years. Really, every single contract is 8 years. And some of that time is quote-unquote active and some is inactive. But yeah, standard Guard contract is 6 years. So I joined in 2000. I drilled with this unit out of Billings all year because I was still in high school. And then that summer, I went to boot camp, but I got mono in the middle of boot camp. So I start my freshman year of college, 9/11 happens. I'm drilling all year because in the National Guard, when you join us, what it's called a split op. They make you do boot camp one summer, and then they let you go to school, and then you do your job training, which is called AIT, Advanced Individual Training, the next year. So all of this was super drawn out for me. Got booted back from boot camp, then did my freshman year of college. Went back, completed my boot camp. I had to start all over again at day one, which I was so mad about.
So what was the time like with these folks after 9/11? Did you find other people asking any questions? How long is the trajectory here before the tide begins to turn, both in your mind and then also in terms of your differentiating from those you were with in the Guard?
At first, everyone was on alert, but the information from the top was not trickling down anywhere. Nobody knew anything. I remember going to drill and being very curious, like, okay, what's the plan? What are the chances we're going to be called up and where will we go? And some people were confused saying, well, we're the National Guard. We defend the state. We wouldn't go. We wouldn't be called up to go. But they ended up pulling reserves and National Guard people first, actually, before they sent the regular Army folks. And that was a surprise. But at first, like that whole first year, as Bush was setting the stage for the invasion of Iraq, getting his ducks in a row and starting the campaign of misinformation about weapons of mass destruction and uranium and all the rest. That whole year, I expected some information, but the leaders would just say, we haven't heard anything from top, just show up to drill, do your job. And me, I wasn't worrying about it too much because I wasn't fully trained yet. I knew that I had to go through a boot camp and then I had a whole nother year and I would go through AIT and I couldn't get called up before I was trained for my job. The job that I had signed up for, I really wanted to be a writer in uniform. I wanted to do press corps stuff or something like that, but there weren't any of those slots open. Of course, there's like two of those slots. They tell you they're available and you can transfer into them, but really no. So I signed up as a fueler, and I needed to get done with fueler school before I was even eligible to get called up. And then when I moved to California, everyone was getting called up. I think in 2003 or 2004, just about every California Guard unit was over in the sandbox. And I remember getting to Camp Roberts, and it was a ghost town. There was hardly anybody there. There was some kind of press corps unit there. And they put me in a unit that was so tiny. It was like five or six people at that point. And they were building a quarry, and their whole job was to revitalize the base. So at that point, I was like, great, I am still under the radar. Like, I think I might be able to do my contract and not get called up and not have to deal with this war that I feel more and more disturbed by. By 2004, 2005, things were kind of descending into civil war.
And the WMDs had played themselves out as grand falsehoods.
Yeah, everyone knew that they weren't there. Everyone knew that at this point, no, we were not seen as saviors. We're seen as invaders and occupiers. But it was like a freight train, this freight train that you could not stop, and things just were getting worse and worse.
I'd like to just take this brief opportunity to interject and just remind folks that you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're speaking with writer, journalist, and musician Rosa Del Duca. Her book is Breaking Cadence, One Woman's War Against the War, from Ooligan Press. She has a companion podcast, Breaking Cadence, Insights from a Modern-Day Conscientious Objector. And Rosa earned an MFA in creative writing from St. Mary's College in California, and her shorter and creative work has been published at places like Calyx, River Teeth, Cut Bank, Grain, and the Los Angeles Review, as well as other literary magazines. After this brief musical break, we're going to come back, and we're going to continue our conversation with Rosa Del Duca, and she's going to talk about her road to conscientious objector and how eventually this brings her where she is today in writing this memoir. So after this break, we'll continue the conversation.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all 31 and he's only 70. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist, and a Baptist, and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you. For me, my friend, and me for you.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we're speaking with Rosa Del Duca. She is a writer, journalist, and musician, grew up in rural Montana, where she joined the Army National Guard before the events of September the 11th. That's 17 years old. And of course, during this long contract, she became not only a conscientious objector, but feminist and unlikely rebel. And that tumultuous time is the focus of her memoir, Breaking Cadence, One Woman's War Against the War. And that's what we're talking about today with Rosa Del Duca. Rosa, before the break, you were talking about your 2004 into 2005, clearly coming to change your mind and come into sort of a heightened sense of consciousness about what was wrong with the war and how people were being perceived in Iraq, U.S. troops, and so forth. This is coming into what, year four, year five of your time in the Guard. So tell listeners what happened up toward the end, and did you get called up? How did things go? For a lot of folks, right around where you're talking about that time period and coming to that realization, a lot of folks in the military had to make some tough choices. And certainly our culture isn't very forgiving of some folks that come to the realizations that you were coming to. So continue your story, please.
Yeah, that was always hanging over my head. Like, well, what are you going to do? You sign this contract and everyone will see you as an absolute traitor scumbag if you even voice any of your objections. But yeah, this is a time when troops are going door to door, terrorizing families, IEDs are blowing up our soldiers who are complaining for, can we get some body armor? Can we get some vehicle armor? But eventually, the government got so desperate for new units to send over to Iraq that I did get called up. I didn't get called up with my unit, but what they were doing was cherry picking jobs from all across the country, like, okay, we need a fueler, we need truck drivers, we need this and that, and then making a unit out of everybody who was left. So I was actually at the campus radio station when my platoon leader called me and said that I was called up and I would be deploying from this unit with a unit out of Louisiana, and I was set to do my final processing in 2 or 3 weeks. I was completely devastated. I was just so torn up about it. I really didn't want to fight in this war. And it was an 18-month deployment. It was just so long. I was 20 years old. And as a journalism student, like, it was kind of a daily weight on my heart, like seeing the coverage or the lack of coverage some days. It would be in the news if the soldier death toll ticked up another even 100. And I just kind of raged and pined and sat and stared at the ocean for a couple hours. But I really didn't think that there was anything I could do. I thought that I would just have to do it. So a couple days later, after I got called up, somehow the ROTC recruiter at my school found out. And he called me up at work and said, hey, you can still join ROTC. All you have to do is sign a 3-year contract extension, and you have to agree to minor in military science. But if you join ROTC right now, you don't have to be deployed right now, and you can become an officer when you go over, and you can finish your college degree. So I really didn't want more time, but I was like, well, maybe the war will end in the next year or two. I was just faced with two bad options. Both were, you know, just wrong for me at this point. I didn't belong, and I realized at this point that I never had belonged. So I did join ROTC. I signed a 3-year contract extension, and then a week later, I still had to go through that processing to get deployed because paperwork moves so slowly. I had to go through all the motions to deploy until that contract with ROTC got finalized by the right people. And at that processing, they tell you to beef up your life insurance, and they do a last physical, and they make you go through a mountain of paperwork, and there's one paper with a line on it that had a box that you could check, and it said, are you a conscientious objector? And it was like a lightning bolt struck me because I saw that term and I was like, yes, that is exactly what I am. My conscience objects to me being in uniform right now. My conscience objects to the war. I'm a conscientious objector. But I had no idea how the Army was defining it. I just thought, oh, that term is like in Vietnam, those guys that would burn their draft cards in the street or run away to Canada. So I didn't know what the heck I was dealing with. I went home, Googled it. I found the GI Rights hotline really quickly. And they're like, are you a member of the military? questioning your role, trying to get out. Want to know about your rights? Yes, yes, yes. I called them up and they explained, yes, you can still be a conscientious objector in today's military, but it's really hard to win. It's this big, long application process, like a series of really detailed essay questions. Then you are interviewed by a chaplain. Then you are interviewed by an Army psychologist. And then an investigating officer is assigned to your case. And they try to dig up dirt on you, make you change your answers, make sure you're serious. They basically interrogate you. And then that investigating officer makes a ruling, which you can rebut or not. And then it takes about a year to go all the way up to the Pentagon.
So yeah. In the meantime, any other thing could happen? Or, you know, you were a student, and so you weren't getting deployed. That's right.
Yeah. So I managed to get out of deployment because I did join ROTC.
You're still staring down that extra contract time.
Yeah. I still had that 3 extra years tacked on. And so it's that during that year when it's working its way up to the Pentagon, you are still drilling. You are still doing all of your duties. You're going to PT. You're going to your military science classes while everyone knows what's up about you.
How did your peers treat you in that period?
When I first found out about CO, there was one thing really that I was like, well, I can't do this. This doesn't apply to me after all. In your application, you have to write about how you believe that any and all wars mm-hmm. are wrong, not just the Iraq War. I didn't. At that point, I was like, okay, I need to buck up. I need to suck it up. I signed these contracts. I got myself into this. I need to own my responsibilities. Nobody else is doing this. No one else is saying, oh, I don't want to go, blah, 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 blah. I was kind of like beating myself up about it. But then over the next 9 months, training to be an officer at a time of war with these kids, they didn't talk about the war. They didn't think about the war. It was like playing army games to them. Meanwhile, I'm analyzing, okay, not only do I have a role in this war now, I am going to be giving orders. I am going to be asked to maybe cover something up or maybe, I don't know what. I kind of descended down the rabbit hole of, okay, I really can't do this until I came to a breaking point and I did call the GRI's hotline back and I started building my case, but it was basically a secret. Mm-hmm. I had to go through this ROTC summer camp. It's a month out in the woods in Fort Lewis, Washington. And I knew that I was going to come back and file my CO application and out myself as a traitor. But during the summer camp, I had to play the game. I had to go through all the motions and act like I was an enthusiastic officer in training with all these other kids, like maybe 20. It was just so stark. Like, I respected them so much in so many ways. Like, they were caring and smart and funny and talented and strong. And at the same time, I could not respect how they thought about the war. I made the mistake of opening my mouth about it one time, like saying, hey, what do you guys think about the war? I just couldn't contain my curiosity. Mm. I was like, do you guys believe in the war? And they're like, right. What do you mean believe? Like yeah. Fairy?
You started to look like you were from outer space or something. Rosa Del Duca, your book is Breaking Cadence, One Woman's War Against the War. We've got a few minutes left in the segment. So what happens? How does this end up at this period, at the end of these contracts? And what are you on to now?
I applied for CO. I got interviewed by the chaplain, the psychologist. The investigating officer accused me of joining fraudulently and demanded that I pay back any cent that the Army ever gave me, and then said that I did not deserve CO status. I had to hire a lawyer to rebut that, and then he rebutted it, went up to the Pentagon, and they gave me a firm no, you're not a conscientious objector. At this point, I was in the Bay Area, and I had to hire another lawyer who, if the Army came after me, he was going to file something called a writ of habeas corpus in federal court. Like, he was poised to sue the federal government on my behalf because when they denied my case, they didn't say why. And that goes against our law of, you know, you can't unlawfully detain someone without a reason. So this whole ordeal is why now I'm doing some truth and recruitment work or trying to do that in schools that will have us. All public high schools, they are required to allow recruiters regular access to campus.
I am aware of that, but a lot of people are not.
The schools also have to give the names, addresses, and phone numbers of all the seniors who don't opt out. They give them to the recruiters. Right. Meanwhile, the group that I'm with, it's just a few people, and we're trying to get into schools, but it's so hard because this is a political topic, and teachers don't have time. They are so overloaded and underpaid. So we're trying to get in there to give students some facts that recruiters don't mention, such as all contracts are 8 years. Mm-hmm. They cannot guarantee what job you have, and they cannot tell you that you're not going to get deployed to a war zone. They can also not guarantee that we're not going to get into an unjust war. The Iraq War is a textbook case of an unjust war, and now the Afghanistan has turned into an unjust war, too.
Look at what just happened in the Iraqi parliament not long ago. I mean, voting, they want the United States out. They, you know, the government of Iraq wants the United States to leave, which is pretty riveting. You know, I mean, that it doesn't get much clearer than that.
And the fact of the matter is we shouldn't have been there in the first place.
There were people that knew at the time. I mean, I was teaching at the time, and I was definitely voicing the concerns about the propaganda, the rush to war, the lack of any actual connection between Iraq, Saddam Hussein, and Osama bin Laden, and Al-Qaeda or Taliban or any of these things. But at the time, there were quite a few of us, but we were so drowned out by the jingoistic chorus from the corporate press and the military-industrial complex and their minions in government. Democrats just collapsed under the weight of all of this, and many of them not only went along with it, but enthusiastically supported this chicanery and this kind of nonsense. Rosa del Duca, you know, Dar Jamal, one of the early Iraq war reporters who just went solo, didn't do the embedded reporting gig and broke so many important mm-hmm. stories about that occupation. He wrote about your book. He said that your book stands as an example of what it takes for someone in the military to stand up for justice, act on their morals, and become a conscientious objector. This is the story. The story of Rosa del Duca's spirit and her tenacity to follow it is a beacon to shine the light for others who choose not to be the cannon fodder of empire. That's what Dar Jamal said about your book, Breaking Cadence. And Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, she said that your book is a tribute to the notion that dissent is the highest form of patriotism, and goes on to praise you as your determination not to fight that war in Iraq will hopefully serve, Medea Benjamin says, as a warning and an inspiration for young Americans across the country. And so you offer us in your book, Breaking Cadence, One Woman's War Against the War, you offer a really important story that a lot of people in the millennial generation, I think, will relate to, and I think could be a really important teaching tool, especially for young people making tough decisions in this economy and with this seemingly endless war. So, Rosa del Duca, can you give us any information about how to contact you or where people can get involved or where they can find your work?
I have a website. It's just rosadelduca.com. You can find out more about the book there, which is available at Powell's Book, Barnes & Noble, IndieBound, and you can always ask your local bookstore and they can order it. The Truth and Recruitment group that I'm part of, it's called Before Enlisting. You can find it at beforeenlisting.org, and there are some really fantastic resources there. There's about a 17-minute documentary-style film there, and it's all veterans dispelling a lot of myths about military service, but it's all taboo topics. You see that uniform and a lot of people in America just clam up and think that it's incredibly unpatriotic to criticize the military in any way. But like Medea Benjamin says, that is the most patriotic, to question things and always want to make them better, especially when recruits are still allowed to join 17, 18 years old. You know, like, we protect kids from so many things, like adult criminal charges, R-rated movies, renting a car or hotel room, but we're not going to protect them. These contracts, they are legally binding. You sign away a lot of rights when you sign that contract, and they're all 8 years long. So I feel really passionate about this.
I'd like to give a shout out too to my colleague and friend Nolan Higdon, who connected us. It's a delight to have you on the program, and what an inspirational and significant and important resource you are, and how important is your story, Rosa del Duca, that people should really hear it. And your publisher, the Ooligan Press, OOLIGAN, has a website, ooligan.pdx.edu connected with Portland State. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a teaching press.
Yeah, and so they actually have reading guides. So if you're listening out there and you're an educator, a teacher, there are reading guides for high school and university and beyond for breaking cadence. And Rosa, I'm sure you'd agree with this. That's high school. That's the time that people need to really be thinking about these issues.
Yes, I wrote this for people in high school considering military service. I really did.
And you are in the Bay Area. Is that right, or are you still down the coast?
I'm up in the Bay Area.
So we should talk and see if we can get you to do some workshops or other kind of talks at local colleges. And definitely, if folks are interested, you can reach her through her website. By the way, when this show goes up, we'll post those links at the Project Censored site so people can follow them that way as well. Rosa Del Duca, thanks so much for joining us today on the Project Censored Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
On the next segment of the Project Censored Show, we welcome back author, lecturer, historian, and media scholar Nolan Higdon. We'll be talking about Election 2020, and more specifically, we'll be addressing a recent study that we had published over at Truthout about the Bernie blackout. It's real, and we've got the screenshots to prove it. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On this segment of the program, we welcome back Nolan Higdon. He is a lecturer in history and media studies. Project Censored listeners, of course, know Nolan Higdon. He was co-host here at the Project Censored Show for some time, and he also is co-host of the Along the Line podcast, and you can learn more at projectcensored.org. Nolan and I wrote a book for City Lights Publishing last year called United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and What We Can Do About It. Well, as a result of that publication, Nolan and I have extended the thesis of United States of Distraction, and we've used it to apply to the 2020 election. In particular, we're looking at the primaries and what's happening within the Democratic Party. We've done several of these pieces for Truthout, for Counterpunch, also at projectcensored.org. The latest piece we did looks from the Bernie blackout to bashing Bernie. It's a study on media framing and propaganda, and over at Truthout, the article is titled, "The Bernie Blackout is Real, and These Screenshots Prove It." This is actually a study going back a couple of months, and so this is something that we also do, not just as media scholars, but also as historians and of contemporary history. And so we went back to take a look at how the corporate press was framing the Democratic primary. And of course, one of the things that was glaringly absent earlier on was any real coverage of candidate Bernie Sanders. The corporate press and the establishment within the Democratic Party really went out of their way, almost acrobatically, to try to bury Sanders, ignore Sanders. And then when the groundswell of support grew and the corporate media found it more and more difficult to simply downplay or ignore the Sanders campaign, they took to attacking him and bashing him. And again, we have a lot of evidence here in a 2,500-word piece. But Nolan Higdon, thanks so much for coming back on the show and joining us about this very timely topic about the Democratic primaries. Of course, we're now past the disaster of the Iowa caucus, so certainly people are talking more about those issues. But this article really leads up to the Iowa caucus. So could you tell our listeners a little bit more about this article and about this study that we've conducted?
Thanks, Mickey, and it's great to be talking to the Project Censored audience once again. The Bernie Blackout piece we wrote really speaks to this effort by members of the media and the Democratic Party to try and marginalize Sanders' very popular campaign. So I think it's important to note this isn't necessarily an endorsement of Bernie Sanders, and nor do I think that Bernie Sanders, the individual, or even Democratic socialism is being targeted here. You have to remember that a political party is usually comprised of multiple components and committees and such and caucuses. And the people who are in power right now in the party, which means the people who get media spots and who gets chairmanships and who get to decide who's going to run in elections, They're all in those positions thanks to donors and the committee seats they have. If a new group of people take over, like a new wing of the party, like the Bernie Sanders wing takes over, all those people's jobs are threatened. Their economic base is threatened. And so they see Bernie Sanders as just a threat, a new takeover of the party. Similarly, in the 1990s, Bill Clinton and the Democratic Leadership Council took over the party, and they got rid of a lot of those old sort of New Deal liberals and replaced them in the party. And those Democratic Leadership Council people are afraid that Sanders is going to do the same thing for them. So we wrote this piece to look at how they're actively working to marginalize the Sanders campaign. And, you know, it's pretty revealing that they're willing to manipulate math, manipulate graphs, and marginalize everything he's doing at every turn.
In this piece, you gathered a lot of these screenshots about the Bernie blackout. It took a while to put together, and so by the time we were approaching the Iowa caucus, Sanders had already begun to break through that blackout and was getting some coverage in corporate media, but it was often very negative and framed in a certain way. So a lot of folks that went to the article, as people are wont to do on the internet or social media, they see a title or a headline, and then they assume they know what's going on, and then they move to the next thing. And so if you just look at the title, people say, well, this isn't a blackout. He's everywhere. This Sanders guy is all over the news. That means that they're not really looking at the study. It goes from the trajectory of being ignored to then being attacked. And of course, we're now in the second round of this series of attacks, coming after the Iowa caucus. And again, one of the themes that comes out again is that 2020 is just sort of like the new 2016. A lot of the same patterns, same kind of players are really working behind the scenes, both in the Democratic National Committee and in corporate media, to sully any kind of progressive challenge within the Democratic Party.
It's an active way of just trying to marginalize his campaign and what it stands for. I mean, we can bring up Iowa. He won the popular vote in Iowa, which I realize doesn't transition into delegates, but technically he won Iowa. But they keep showing Pete Buttigieg ahead in a percentage of delegates. But actually, in the actual delegate count, there's 41 delegates. As of right now, it looks like Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders are both going to get 10. So if anything, there's a tie for first in delegates, and Bernie's the leader in the popular vote. But that's not the way it's being portrayed in media. It's this big win for Pete Buttigieg. And going back to our book and our thesis, one has to wonder if the ground game would have been different for Klobuchar, Warren, and Sanders had they not had this impeachment trial. Perhaps in those last 10 days leading up to the Iowa caucus, those guys could have been on the ground, and maybe it could have been enough to edge out Buttigieg down further, Warren up higher, maybe even Klobuchar going ahead of Biden, et cetera. But the impeachment trial largely acted as a distraction. And I think the way they're calling this race, if you can call it that, it's also a distraction in that Pete Buttigieg really tied for delegates with Sanders and fell behind Sanders in the popular vote.
So what you're suggesting here is the devil's in the details, and the corporate media often gloss over details that don't necessarily support their centrist pro-corporate narrative. And of course, at the DNC, the chair, Tom Perez, nominating the 2020 convention standing committees, Kevin Gostola over at shadowproof.com, recently deconstructed that and took a really hard look at who exactly are these people. Gostola breaks this down, and he basically says, look, the people behind the scenes at the DNC are basically retreads from the Clinton campaign. We've already seen publicly people like Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, openly disparaging the Sanders campaign, openly saying that Sanders must be stopped, even though in the popular opinion polls, we see that Sanders has amazing support, such that corporate media had to move from ignoring his candidacy or downplaying it to full-on attacking it. And that, of course, is something that comes out in the article. So, Nolan Higdon, censoring progressivism, where's Bernie? This is the beginning of the article. Could you talk to our listeners, give them some examples of how MSNBC and other networks, CNN, manipulated graphics or made an effort to try to frame Sanders completely out of contention?
And some of it's quite pernicious, where they would show, you know, the top five candidates in like a national poll. And even though Sanders would be number one or number two, they would put him on like third on the list. And so even though the numbers on the graphic clearly showed that he was in first or second place, his name would be placed third or fourth. So if the news user didn't actually look at the numbers, they wouldn't know where Sanders was placing. CNN did this as well with Latino voters. And they placed Sanders, even though he was in the top two, they placed him down at the bottom with Latino voters in California. And this kind of gets to the other side of it. By manipulating these graphics, it can fit into these baseless narratives that the corporate press creates, like concepts of electability or that Bernie Sanders can't create a diverse coalition. Bernie has one of the most diverse coalitions, but you wouldn't know that if you look at the graphics. And this idea of electability, it's not really clear how they define electability. Apparently Hillary Clinton had electability, but she lost in the Electoral College. Apparently Joe Biden had electability, but he came in fourth in the Iowa caucus. So they come up with these moving goalposts to always marginalize these progressive candidates. And even when these progressive candidates go out of their way to disprove whatever those goalposts are, the goalpost just simply moves again, and it's a new thing. For instance, Sanders was attacked for being too divisive in 2016 and 2020. Yet, as you pointed out, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton can openly talk about how they would stop or wouldn't endorse the Sanders campaign. So these double standards and moving goalposts, they start to shape media narratives. Probably the most pernicious thing we saw right before the Iowa caucus was in that last debate where Warren claimed that behind the scenes, Bernie had said a woman could never be president. Sanders denied it. And the CNN debate moderator asked Warren how she felt when Sanders said a woman could not be elected president. It was really kind of fascinating. Rather than figure out which one of those two was lying, because it had to be one of them, they treated it as if it was fact. And in fact, Jess McIntosh, a CNN commentator who previously worked for Hillary Clinton, after the debate, she said that Sanders was lying because they had reporting that proved at CNN that he had said it. And luckily, Anderson Cooper quickly corrected her and said, no, we don't have proof that he said it. We have proof that someone claims that they heard from Warren that he said it. But it was just constructing those type of media narratives that really marginalized progressive candidates. And if you don't dig deeper than the quote-unquote news, you're really susceptible to believe these falsehoods, which can marginalize a Sanders candidacy or other progressives.
Again, this is an ongoing series of articles that you and I are doing that stem from the United States of Distraction book, where we're applying that theme to corporate media. And in fact, in another piece that we did for Truth Out late last year, we talked about how we really need critical media literacy education. We really need to reinvigorate our civics education in this country so people are more aware of how news, information, campaigns, and so forth are shaped. And back to the Bernie blackout issue, it was later last year when we were discussing this that this isn't just the corporate media. CNN, MSNBC, CBS, they're all in on this kind of disappearing act. But it's also important to remember that this is also the case at PBS NewsHour, and it's also the case at National Public Radio's Morning Edition, major public media programs, allegedly public media. But we also have to remember that most of the funding for these programs does come by underwriters, not from viewers like you or listeners like you. And the underwriters are corporate. And we've long pointed out the biases at PBS, and in some cases, some of the omissions of Sanders on the run-up to the Iowa caucus. PBS and NPR were some of the most egregious offenders of this. And I know Norman Solomon has called this out, as well as a few other folks. Of course, Solomon is out and out in support of Sanders, whereas you and I, we're not writing about this as a candidate in terms of saying, like, hey, our candidate's getting sacked by the media. We don't identify that way. We're simply looking as historians and media scholars by saying, hey, candidate X is getting a raw deal. You know, Project Censored, we did this years ago with corporate media, the Republican parties and their primaries with Ron Paul, who was marginalized and just disappeared as a more libertarian-leaning Republican. I recall distinctly that he was running neck and neck with Rudy, America's Mayor Giuliani, and he was tied for third or fourth. Paul was raising a lot of money, which is the big metric in American politics for, quote, electability, as you brought up. But Paul was routinely panned as unelectable, too radical, anti-war, anti-Federal Reserve, etc. But when they got to Giuliani, who was polling the same as Paul, Giuliani was somehow the dark horse. He could do it. He was there for America when they needed us after 9/11, so to speak. And their selective treatment of the candidates couldn't be more obvious for people who are aware of the broader historical contexts and the positions of the candidates. So this isn't just like, hey, our guy's getting bashed in the media or ignored. This is a serious historical trend of major corporate and establishment forces really trying to get their person in the White House. And for a while, it was Biden. Then it looked like the corporate establishment was leaning to Warren. And after Iowa, it seems like it's Buttigieg.
They're wrapping themselves around Buttigieg now, it seems. But I do want to go back to what you said about PBS. I think it's crucial for our listeners to remember that that's larger size government, a more active federal government that was ushered in with the New Deal, that really started getting gutted by the 1970s. So the gutting of the New Deal is about a decade longer than the existence of the actual New Deal style of government. So PBS and things like that, they still have public in the name, but they're hardly public. You know, liberals have kind of been on the run for like half a century in this country. It's crucial to remember that. But to your point about creating narratives, Ron Paul, remember he won like the straw polls in Iowa in late 2011 and 2012. And they didn't announce him as a winner till like June of 2012 because the media just couldn't deal with the fact that Ron Paul was popular in the party. It's a reoccurring problem in American politics. So long as, and this goes back to the thesis of our book, United States of Distraction, as long as we buy into hyper-partisan narratives and sensational content, we kind of run in circles fighting the quote-unquote other side rather than recognizing how the fight against the other side on both sides is really emaciating the country. I, for some reason, sat through the State of the Union address, and I got to tell you, I really felt like I was in an episode of reality television where you have these figures and celebrities standing up, and there's these appeals to emotion and this sort of hyper-partisan rhetoric. Rush Limbaugh, of all people, is there and gets a Medal of Honor from the president in real time, and it's a surprise. It seemed like one of those shows where you win a new house or something and they surprise you. But as long as we're distracted by all this political theater, it makes it a lot easier for them to build these narratives. I think people are just hit with so much information, they can't dig deeper under the media narratives. They sort of take them at face value, the ideas of electability and things like that.
Moving from one distraction to another, we're so distracted by the next distraction that there's little time or energy spent more deeply analyzing that which just occurred. I'd like to remind listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On the line, we have Dr. Nolan Higdon, author and lecturer of history and media studies at California State University East Bay, also at Diablo Valley College. And his most recent publication is United States of Distraction, co-authored with me at City Lights Publishers. So after this brief musical break, we're going to continue talking about media framing and propaganda in the 2020 election. Stay with us.
Welcome to the Holy City, a silver screen built with a lens and a low self-esteem. A teenager's plea for meaning and means. We're selling the news. See, opinions are easier to swallow than facts. The grays instead of the whites and the blacks. If you shoot it too they won't come back, we're selling the news. See, money speaks volumes louder than words. Or virtues with wings, maybe not quite at first. But salaries are paid by the ads, not the birds. We're selling the news. See, all men are equal, all is for sale. A powerful dog has been chasing his tail. The lowest common denominator prevails. We're selling the news.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we're looking at media framing and propaganda around the 2020 election, more specifically around the Democratic primaries. And we're joined by media scholar and historian, Dr. Nolan Higdon. Nolan Higdon is a longtime contributor to Project Censored. Today, we're talking about a study that Nolan Higdon and I had published at truthout.org. The Bernie blackout is real, and these screenshots prove it. We're, of course, moving beyond the Bernie blackout. And we want to now talk about the rest of the study that goes from the Bernie blackout to bashing Bernie. And so after we look at distorted polls and the Bernie shuffle and the Great Disappearing Act that was done by the corporate media, what we later see is the talking heads bashing Bernie. And Matt Taibbi noted this in his latest book, Hate Incorporated, that a lot of these news personalities are paid to act as experts, even when they might be ignorant of subject matter. And they're basically there to put forward specific opinions that those that invite them there would like them to air in at least seemingly objective fashion. But again, as the study here is going to point out, this really isn't the case. And of course, we're not the only ones that have noticed the blackout to bashing phenomenon. So we mentioned in the study, Jason Johnson, who basically is a kind of a retread from 2016 over at MSNBC, downplaying the Sanders campaign at each turn. Nolan Higdon, talk a little bit about some of the material that came out here about the concerted efforts to not just downplay, but aggressively attack the progressive campaign of Bernie Sanders.
As you point out, I mean, Matt Taibbi kind of talks about this, that some studies long ago showed that audiences do not like inarticulate people. They don't like to typically see poverty on television. So news media tries to pack its pundits with people who are articulate and sound like experts. It's more important how they are perceived rather than the content of what they're saying. In fact, Roger Ailes was the genius behind this. Roger Ailes, when he would figure out which pundit to hire, he would have them do a broadcast and he'd watch it with the volume down. So it was all about how you looked, not what you were actually saying. This is how the news media draws in attention. But what the problem is a lot of the folks that they bring on there, they do have an agenda. They bring in a lot of people with political backgrounds. This was exposed in 2008 by the New York Times. They also bring in a lot of people from the intelligence and military community on television as well, who are selling narratives that serve either a political party, the intelligence community, the military, or all of the above. And so someone like Sanders threatens really the party leadership, threatens the economic models that underpin the corporate media and support the intelligence community and military. So he's kind of an easy target to go after. And some of these people do this stuff unwittingly. You were talking about Jason earlier. He announced in August of 2019 that Bernie Sanders is done and that his campaign is over. Here, Sanders is winning or tying at least for victory in the first caucus. And he assumed that Warren was going to take over the progressive lane. And it looks like Warren, you know, she may be one or two primary votes away from dropping out of the race. So it's just another sort of illustration of how these supposed experts have no clue what they're talking about, but they fill so much of that 24-hour news void.
You know, it was only until very recently that most of these major corporate media networks, when they had post-panel discussions of anything that had happened after any of the debates, there wasn't a single voice that spoke favorably about Sanders' positions.
You know, Sanders' proposals like Medicare for All or tuition-free college are always sort of mocked, and the question comes up, how are you going to pay for it? But just recently, we had the federal investigation into the Afghanistan wars, and in addition to multiple findings, including the government lying to the public about what was going on in Afghanistan, they basically concluded that we wasted almost $2 trillion on a war, even though we knew we couldn't win it. And I find that number really, really important for numerous reasons, but one of them being that the amount of student debt in this country right now is $1.6 trillion, i.e. if you didn't go into this war in Afghanistan, you could have had tuition-free college. And it's interesting to me, we never ask where the money is when we want to go blow up brown people, but when we want to invest in our people and give them an education, then all of a sudden that's just a bridge too far. We can't afford it. And I think those are kind of the media framing mechanisms which really hurt progressive candidates who are trying to move the country in a different direction.
The propaganda, the framing, the hyperbolic and heated rhetoric seems to be on the uptick in the recent State of the Union address. We talk about political theater. Matt Taibbi references things like the frame of professional wrestling and scripted reality television, right up to Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, tearing up a copy of Trump's speech at the end. This is the kind of theater that's a stand-in for actual substantive debate. And let's not forget, this is right after basically failed impeachment attempt by the Democratic Party.
It was an abysmal failure. It was a sort of cheap ploy to the Democratic voters. You and I haven't talked about this yet, but this is something that concerns me a great deal as well. I don't know how many of our listeners are familiar with C-SPAN, but C-SPAN usually broadcasts what's going on in Congress and political speeches. The 24-hour news networks, I think somewhere along the way, they figured out it was cheaper to act like C-SPAN because they covered the impeachment trial from gavel to gavel. And in a nation of 330 million people, there are so many news stories going on in a day. I found it just ridiculous that there was wall-to-wall coverage of this impeachment trial that ended up going nowhere. The country will be the same, with the one difference being Trump's approval ratings have actually gone up since this thing started.
Well, it certainly ate up all the media time. From NPR to Pacifica, across the spectrum. I mean, it was all impeachment all the time. And again, if you go and read more of the alternative or independent press, read some of the foreign press, there's a lot of things that have been going on. You just happened to mention the Afghan papers, which just flown totally under the radar of the corporate media, even though it's this generation's Pentagon papers, essentially. Just shows the lies, the deceit, the waste, the fraud, the human rights violations, war crimes, stuff that ought to be front page news. But it gets kicked to the curb for impeachment, and when that's not enough, it's grief porn and Kobe Bryant all day and all week into the month. And again, I'm not making light of those personal tragedies in any way. But the point is that where are the cameras all up in the grill of the, you know, 30,000 people across the world that die every day because of malnutrition or starvation? Media is a really powerful tool, and it can be used for many ends. And again, part of the ongoing series here of the United States of Distraction is to show that the more and more we allow ourselves to be distracted, you know, the more and more we end up down that rabbit hole, and the harder it is to get out and even figure out what's going on and where we're heading as a society. So one of the things concluded in the piece here about the way in which this election is being framed, the primaries are being framed, you know, we wrote that it's high time that we not only reveal but remove the corporate thumbs of the establishment press and bot party leaders from the public scales of our elections. And Nolan Higdon, do you see us in any way being able to shine that light through the spring? And do you see any possibility for a Sanders campaign to be a serious contender, given how many hurdles from the establishment are being thrown in the way?
There's sort of two mechanisms of theories on this. One is that the same sort of hurdles he experienced in 2016 will hurt him here in 2020. That's really what our article is about how 2020 is the new 2016. However, it does seem at some level that this is like the last gasp of the establishment. I think a lot of these news media outlets are finding themselves not to be as important in 2020, even as much as they were in 2016. I felt like the New York Times endorsement was sort of an example of that. That used to be a huge deal that would get people a lot of funding and a big bump in the polls. And really, there was almost no measurable impact on the Warren or Klobuchar campaign when the New York Times did that. And this is the first election where millennials will be the majority of the voting bloc, and most of them do not receive their news from newspapers or television. A lot of them using like online outlets and independent podcasts, which again, raises its own set of problems. But it might be a new era. So it'll be interesting to see if Sanders can take strength from this new fragmented media while downplaying its problems and avoiding the problems that come with traditional media. Right now, though, it looks like the traditional media is going with its same sort of playbook in attacking Sanders and progressivism.
Today, we've been talking about a recent study published at Truthout. The Bernie blackout is real, and these screenshots prove it. Likely, we'll have Nolan Higdon back on throughout the spring and throughout the primary season. Cool. Nolan Higdon, thanks so much for joining us again on the Project Censored Show.
Thank you for having me.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why
you've been listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Peter Phillips and I founded this program back in 2010. We're on close to 50 stations around the United States now. Our senior producer is Anthony Fest. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. Thanks for tuning in, and we will see you next time.
Minds collapsing, all the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, hypnotized by the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening, time's running out to reach all potential, fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu, we got that love of the brothers in our